Cynthia Molobita, and this is the fifth of five sessions looking at the topics of economic globalization and the promise of God living within us. The title of the session tonight is Bread for the Journey Toward Sustainable, Equitable Economy of Life. Before we get into the subject matter for tonight, I'd like to point out three excellent books that are in the bookstore that have been purchased by the bookstore in relationship to this series of sessions. Also, one other book that I'll be drawing upon heavily tonight, this collection of writings by Martin Luther, which is edited by and collected by Timothy Lull, is beautifully done in the theological roots of the choices of selections in the book. So I highly recommend it if you want to pursue more Luther at any point in relationship to the topics this week or another time. I'm not sure if it's in the bookstore, but it can certainly be ordered elsewhere. Could we have a quick show of hands regarding to indicate what people have been here, what people are new to these sessions? Okay, tonight is a lot of new topics. How about that? All right. Pardon me? Yes. There's a lot of terrain to cover tonight, so let me very succinctly map the terrain that we have already covered. We have been looking at, we've been looking at two fundamental questions. In emphasizing different questions in different sessions. The first question, let me not even go into those first. Let me start elsewhere. We began in the first session looking at the dynamics of economic globalization. What do we mean by the concept of economic globalization? And also, what are the threats that economic globalization poses? I suggested that it poses tremendous threats to people who are poor, that the current globalizing economy widens the gap between rich and poor, that it poses threats to Earth's very life support systems, our earth and air and water, that it poses threats to democracy and threats to cultural diversity. Now, that claim that I've just made in a brief paragraph could take many books and many, many years for us to map out. And instead of providing a lot of data and a lot of argument, I have drawn upon a few voices of people from other parts of the globe and this part of the globe, a few voices to symbolize or indicate what I mean by that claim. I'll repeat a couple of those voices tonight to tell you the kind of crisis that we are attempting to look at in these sessions. One of them is the voice of a strawberry picker in Mexico. My work for about 10 years was with the Center for Global Education. I brought delegations of people to Central America and Mexico. And on one of those, I'll never forget a strawberry picker who, without tremendous anger or bitterness in her voice, at least not personally towards us, said, "You know, our children die of hunger because this land grows strawberries for your tables all year round, instead of growing corn and beans and rice for our children." It's the kind of statement that changes your life in a certain sense if you take it seriously. In line with that, I read to you just a few lines from the 1998 edition of the United Nations Human Development Report, an annual report. 3/5 of people in developing countries have no access to basic sanitation. Almost 1/3 are without safe drinking water. Installation of water and sanitation for all would cost $9 billion. $11 billion is spent annually on ice cream in Europe. $8 billion is spent annually for cosmetics in the US alone. Basic health care and nutrition would cost $13 billion for all. $17 billion is spent on pet food in Europe and the U.S. It's a symbolic statement, a real statement and a symbolic statement, to make the point that I'm trying to make. Finally, one additional voice speaking to the threat to Earth's life support systems. This voice comes from the State of the World Report, which is written by the World Watch Institute annually, and is a annual report that is read worldwide, a highly, highly read and respected report. While human life depends upon the planet's life systems, nearly every natural system on the planet is disintegrating, and the human species is the cause of it. Reversing this trend calls for a restructuring of the global economy. It calls for replacing our consumer culture with a less materialistic and far more environmentally literate way of life. The fate of our children depends on it in ways that we can barely begin to conceive. So, what we are doing is holding up those voices and identifying a haunting contradiction. We are a people, the people of Jesus Christ, called to love our neighbors, actively to serve their well-being. On the other hand, and in stark contradiction, we live as participants in this global economic structure that exploits neighbors, damages Earth, and to a large extent benefits us, enables our standard of living. That's the contradiction that we're holding up and grappling with together. I have said before, and I will say it forever, I think it's much easier to run away, to not face it, to make excuses not to face it, and I think it is an act of courage to face that contradiction. Someone said to me a couple of days ago after hearing the first three sessions, he said, "Cynthia, I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and the contradiction was gnawing at my heart." And it seems to me that it's a courageous heart that will wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and be gnawed at by this kind of contradiction. In the first week, the first session, we simply looked at economic globalization, what's going on, and looked at those threats. In the second session, we tried to look at what I think is a terribly important question, and that is, why do we comply? Why do we acquiesce? Given the incredible resources we have to know and to act, why do we acquiesce? In the third session, in the fourth session, we looked at Luther's economic ethics and some of the resources, the fascinating resources that he offers. There are many caveats to looking at Luther, but he offers norms and principles for economic life that radically challenged the emerging capitalism of his day and that radically challenge the global economic order of our day. We'll look into that again this week, and I think the fourth session together, perhaps. Taking one step back on our third day together, we simply looked at some of the ways in which, if we're going to dig into the lives of our faith ancestors for moral and spiritual resources today, what are the barriers to doing that and how do we overcome those barriers? So today, we move now to the new territory for today. And we ask this, if it is indeed true that the global economic structures of which we are a part in the everyday decisions and actions of our life are an affront to neighbor love, how is it possible to reshape our economic lives to be consistent with love for neighbor and love for Earth? How can we go about that awesome task? Which is, in fact, an awesome task, given that our clothes and our transportation and our recreation and our food is all wrapped up in the global economy. It seems to be to me that the ingredients of responding to that question, how can we undertake this kind of radical change, the ingredients are many. I like to see them as questions. One of the questions, of course, is what are the alternatives? What could be different? How could things be different? What are our alternative ways of buying and selling and investing and producing? What are alternative ways of eating? And the alternatives are so very present already. There are people, little-known people throughout this globe, throughout this state, who are developing theoretically and living into economic alternatives. The movie that we saw here last night, or was it this morning? Beyond Organic, was a story about agriculture. Agriculture that wouldn't be mega business, monocropping millions of acres and depleting the soil in 10 years and shipping food. The movie said that the average tablespoon of food that we eat is shipped from 1,000 miles away. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that do to, in the aggregate, what does that do to the use of fossil fuels if our food is shipped from 1,000 miles away in general? So the movie was demonstrating many alternatives being undertaken by ranchers, small farmers, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So I just want to say, in the question of what are the alternatives, it's incumbent upon us to dig them out. And the resources exist. And that's why that's not the question we're going to dig into tonight. I think there are tougher questions. The second one I would ask is, why do we agree? What stops us? What keeps us going in such a malformed way that we agree to economic injustice? The third question is, where is the power to change, even when we know that alternatives exist? Where do we generate the power within us to do differently? How have people throughout the ages generated the moral, spiritual power to swim upstream, even if it meant in the second century defying the Roman Empire and saying that Jesus is Lord, not Caesar, even if it meant defying Nazi Germany? Where does that kind of power come from? And that's the question that we touch on a little bit tonight. I believe that humanity, the human species, will need to dig deep into its faith traditions, and in all of these faith traditions, find moral spiritual power. The one in which we sit, presumably most of us here, is the Christian faith tradition. So digging deep there, we find gems. We find a tradition of resistance in our history. We find gems of moral power. One of them that I find utterly fascinating is a particular promise. And that is the promise that God's compassionate, just-making, unquenchable love for creation may live within us. Moral spiritual power to craft ways of economic life, which, in Luther's words, seek the common good of all, flow from the crucified and living Christ dwelling within us in community. The more people fully receive and become the love of Christ, the more able we are to, in community, resist injustice and revision and rebuild alternative ways of living. This promise, this claim that God lives in us, has been made by voices in our tradition throughout history. Can any of you very briefly name any of those voices? Do you remember any of them? I'll read a couple just throughout time. One is the voice of the author of the book of 1 John. Who says in chapter 4, if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is perfected in us. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. Now, we've all probably heard it since we were in Sunday school at 5 years of age, but it's an incredible statement. Hear also the words of one of my increasingly favorite ancestors in the faith, Hedewig of Antwerp, who was a Flemish poet in the 13th century. This is a vision she's writing, recounting, and she's describing the voice of the Holy Spirit speaking to her. And the Spirit says, "See and receive my Spirit. With regard to all things, know that I love am in them, And when you fully bring yourself to me, you will be love as I am love. Go forth and live what I am. Divine love, a burning fire which shall never, never cease in all the endless ages to come. Haidowich was pretty profound and lived out a lot of risks in living the love that she knew to be divine love in her. Here also, and this is the last one here, a contemporary feminist theologian, Sally McFaig, an eco-feminist theologian concerned with the vast sphere of economic justice and ecological justice, she says, "This is our hope against hope, that our efforts on behalf of our planet are not ours alone, but that the source and power of life in the universe is working in and through us for the well-being of all creation, including our tiny part of it." Well, when I began to hear more and more of these voices studying church history, I began to think that they ought to be taken very, very seriously in the face of a situation which goes beyond human hope, goes beyond human reason. As Molefe Tsele, a Lutheran South African theologian, said, the evils entailed in the globalizing economy today go beyond human agency. And he was appealing to us to appeal to the power of God. Well, we turn now to consider this particular promise in as it is expressed by Martin Luther. And we consider also the implications of this promise in Luther for economic life, as Luther construed and prescribed economic life to be. I'm going to be reading a number of excerpts from Luther tonight, and I don't think I'll necessarily say where all of them come from, but at any time you need to know, want to know, just raise your hand and I'll tell you what treatises or sermons they come from. The theological foundation of Luther's economic ethics, as we discussed last night, establishes not only the obligation to neighbor love, but the power for neighbor love. And that foundation is this: true Christians, having received God's love through grace alone — these are my words, not Luther's — true Christians, having received God's love through grace alone, are filled with God, that is Luther, and grow to embody God's love for others and receive it from others. Said differently, true Christians grow toward being people who love neighbor with God's indwelling love, thus serving the well-being of the community, and particularly the well-being of the needy ones, as Luther says. Widely accepted economic practices that undermine the common good or the well-being of the poor are to be subverted, that is, defied and replaced with radical alternatives by the power of Christ's love. That is my interpretation of Luther's connection between God living in us as love and our economic lives. I'd like to have us look at this claim a little bit more closely. It is nuanced differently in different places, but it is present in many of Luther's writings, both his well-known treatises and his sermons, which are perhaps less read by most of us and which are fascinating to read. Rather than doing something more elaborate that would take more time, what I'd like to do is just read to you four or five very brief excerpts from varied sermons and treatises that are spots in which Luther explicitly speaks about God indwelling us. And maybe as you listen, you might think about if this is the kind of thing you've learned about Luther in your upbringings. It's nothing that I had ever encountered, and I was a cradle Lutheran and kind of took in Luther by osmosis and then academically for years of my life, but I never knew that he said these things. So you might keep that in mind as you listen. It's just a few excerpts. First, this is one of the exceedingly great promises granted to us, that we should become partakers of the divine nature, and should be so highly honored as not only to be loved by God through Jesus Christ, but should even have the Lord himself dwelling completely in us. Another citation. This is regarding a person in whom God dwells. This is what Luther says. You know, I'm going to apologize to those of us, and I hope it's all of us, who are offended by strictly male language for human beings. But I'm using Luther's male language because it's Luther, and it maybe enforces to us how much theology until recently spoke in these terms. So that's the caveat in the apology for sticking to his language. One in whom God dwells makes daily progress in life and good works, is useful to God and man. Through him, that is through one in whom God dwells, men and countries benefit. Such a man's words, life, and doings are God's. Another quote, for through faith Christ is in us, indeed one with us. Another citation, through Christ's love we are to be changed and to make the infirmities of all other Christians our own. We are to take upon ourselves their form and their necessity, and all the good that is within our power we are to make theirs, that they may profit from it. We are changed into one another and are made into a community of love. Christians are indeed called and made the habitation of God, and in them God speaks, rules, and works. Divine power may be poured into our hearts, written as a fiery flame on the heart, and making it burn with love and delight in whatever pleases God, creating new courage so that one serves the people. I don't know, does that sound like the Luther that you learned? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but to me it's a statement, it's a challenge for us to take seriously what it might mean to be made one with all others, to have a fiery flame on our hearts so that we have courage to serve the people in light of the fact that our shirts are made in sweatshops, we're investing in multinational companies that are pulling money in and out of economies that fall because the money comes out and people die. Our kids' soccer balls are made by little boys in Indochina who lose their eyes from the strain of making soccer balls all day long. Our lives are wrapped up in something other than neighbor love. In reading these kinds of citations from Luther, I think it's crucial to note that union with Christ, or the indwelling Christ in Luther, is very, very distinctly different from the assumptions of medieval theology. In a number of ways that we won't go into all of the ways, but a few of them are these. Medieval theology held that salvation depended upon a kind of union with Christ, and that union with Christ depended upon being Christ-like. So you became Christ-like in order to win salvation. And that happened through works, it happened through the sacraments, many things. Luther defied that notion entirely. For Luther, union with Christ, or the indwelling Christ, has nothing to do with anything that we earn. It has nothing to do with being like God. We are not God-like, and Christ comes to dwell in us. Christ comes to dwell in us as a gift from God, not as something we've earned through our own perfection. The transformation toward being people who love is a gift from God, and it comes through the Christ living in us, but not as something that we have earned. We haven't earned Christ to come live in us. This is pure gift. So I'm not insinuating in any way that Luther was a medieval theologian and did believe that we're saved by what we do, by becoming perfect, by becoming holy. It was quite the opposite of that. And there's much more complexity to those differences in that caveat, but I do want to make that very clear. It's all good and well to say that Luther believed that God lives in us. It's all good and well to say that Haidowich did, or that the author of the first book of John did, or that Sally McVeigh does, or even that we do. But what does that say about our economic lives? And that's kind of the question at hand tonight. For Luther, the relationship between this indwelling God and the norms he established for economic life are, that relationship is established by what he calls two principles of Christian doctrine. And I'll read again, just briefly, those two principles. They're to be found in the sacrament, what's it called? The sacrament of the holy and true body and blood of Christ. And you can see that one in this book. Luther identifies two principles of Christian doctrine. The first is that Christ gave himself that we may be saved, and we are saved by no effort of our own. The second is, and I quote Luther, love. As he gives himself for us, so we too are to give ourselves with might and main for our neighbor. Luther insists that these two principles are inseparable. They are, I quote, inscribed together as on a tablet, which is always before our eyes and which we use daily. These two principles of Christian love are very consistent with what he identifies as two kinds of righteousness. And many of you may be familiar with his treatise called Two Kinds of Righteousness. There are two fundamental things that happen to us when we are made righteous, when we are justified by God. The first is, and neither of these are earned, they are gift. First, we are given a radically different relationship with God. We are forgiven and become righteous in God's sight. This occurs by the grace of God alone through faith. After this, we are placed in a radically different relationship to others, and this is the second kind of righteousness. This righteousness, I quote Luther, does not seek its own good, but that of another, and in this, its whole way of living exists. According to the second kind of righteousness, the purpose of human activity, including economic activity, is this. The Christian does not live for himself alone, but lives for all men on earth. No, excuse me. The Christian does not live for himself alone, but he lives also for all men on earth. Rather, he lives only for others and not for himself. The Christian should be guided in all his works by this thought and contemplate this one thing alone, that he may serve and benefit others in all that he does, considering nothing except the need and advantage of the other, each caring for and working for the other. This is a truly Christian life. I will give myself as a Christ for my neighbor. The points I'd like to make are two. That definition of life is distinctly different from the mandates of our globalizing economy. We've talked about this extensively over the week. Take a moment to think. Just think for a moment about contradictions that you see in that description of Christian life and the way we live our economic lives today. Can you name some examples?
Well, just wanting a lot of things. We seem to be very, wanting to have a lot of possessions.
Okay. That's distinctly different from having a focus on attending to the needs of perhaps the homeless other in our midst. That's the perfect example, really. Others?
I think the whole idea of ownership itself, in a sense of, I have this, I have this more than the other person has this.
True. The concept of ownership, and that points out that many of our fundamental assumptions are going to be challenged by this kind of norm. Someone else pointed out yesterday, I think, that when we sell a house in Seattle, when you sell your house, your priority is getting the highest price you can get. You don't take into consideration the needs of someone who needs a house. You wouldn't dream of it, really. Your priority is to get the highest price you can get, which is distinctly different from this norm of life that Luther is pointing out. Any other thoughts? How about the ways in which we invest? Diane?
If I could just comment on that one, though, because I think that's a really good, pertinent example. Because I do think, thinking of myself having sold my home a year ago, and thinking about that, if I could have believed, or other people that I know could believe that in selling their home in the market, that it could have contributed both to the affordability of a home for someone who might not have been able to afford it, and also that it would have impacted with some restraint the galloping house price.
Right.
You know, there would have been a willingness to do that.
Yes.
The likelihood, though, that it would have been purchased by someone who was then going to make a great profit on the home makes, you know, winds up conditioning that decision or altering the decision in a way that I just, the complexities and so much of this global stuff has to do with the powerlessness engendered by, you know, what can be done to impact all of the weave, woven, you know, intricacy of things. Then you wind up making a decision that is not a decision of resistance, but it's a decision of compliance.
Well, Diane, I'd like to speak to that just briefly and then take other hands. I think that what you've just said is to make one of the most important points we can make, and that is that lifestyle changes are extremely important. They're crucial in changing the nature of economic activity on the earth today, but they're certainly thoroughly insufficient. We are beckoned by that very dynamic to go beyond our individual lifestyle decisions to communal activity, to working collectively to make a difference. And there are so many forms of collective activity. What would it be in, you were selling a house in the Seattle area. What would it be if in a particular area, a people decided that, and homeowners who stand to benefit a lot by this galloping house price. What if homeowners were to come together and say, it's not okay. We can't have prices going up so much that teachers in our community can't live in Seattle anymore. If they don't already own a home, they have to live an hour and a half out of Seattle and drive in so that they can start teaching high school at 7:30 in the morning because they can't afford a house. What if homeowners were going to say, rather than collecting on this increasingly galloping market, what if we were to impose a new tax that said that there's a graduated tax, and taxes on houses that are over the median, $250,000, pay a much higher property owner's tax, and houses that are $1 million pay a vastly higher tax. I mean, politically unsavory concepts, but that's a kind of more collective notion of how do we go at this. I'm utterly convinced that as church communities and political communities, we need to reclaim our political beings and work towards policy changes, as well as individual lifestyle changes. And that is intimately a part of Luther's word. Never is the human being an agent of God's love singularly in his writings. It is in the communion. Other hands then. I know there were a few up. Stacy?
I know that there are many ways to start creating solutions, but in relation to what we're talking about with property and real estate, I think that there's about 10 or 15 different cities in the United States that have started up a fair, or that a working hour is equal no matter what you do, and they have currency in different cities. I think Syracuse, New York is one of the places, and there's a few other cities that the Chamber of Commerce and other places have created their own currency that can be used in that city. And so if you work an hour at the library, or if you work an hour at the paper mill, that your hour, you can, instead of getting a paycheck in just U.S. currency, you could get part of your paycheck in this currency, so that everyone could fairly receive the same services with this currency within their region. And that just seems like a step towards what we're talking about with real estate.
And that's also a form of more collective activity rather than only individual lifestyle activity.
And these aren't things that are just happening on communes. It's a citywide thing.
Well, I didn't know about that. It's fascinating. There were a couple of other hands up. Yes. Yes.
I just had a couple comments to throw into the ring. I hope that I heard your reading of Luther correct, but it sounded like he was saying admonishing us to love our neighbor, that we should be loving our neighbor rather than ourselves, something like that. Am I close?
You are saying exactly what I said he said. Yes. But there are caveats attached
to it,
but yes. Yes.
And I think that's really a dangerous thought. And I find it personally very unhealthy for me to start talking about not loving myself. I don't think that's biblical. And I don't think it would help me very much not to do that. And I don't think it would help anybody else. If I'm not going to take care of myself and love myself, then I don't think I'm going to be any good to anybody else. So, you know, whether Luther's saying that or you're saying that or no, it's just something I'm concerned about. And the other thing is I liked your example about imposing a tax on real estate sales that where the house sells for a high price. Did I say that right?
Or where the house is owned at a high value. I mean, I'm not sure if the tax should come on when it's sold or just ownership tax. I'm not sure, but the idea is yes,
that you're going to tax people that have high-priced houses.
Yeah, that was the general idea.
And I just don't put a lot of hope in much change going on. It's sort of like Robin Hood. Taking from the rich and giving to the poor, and I just wonder how many people's heart that's going to change if their taxes are increased.
Yes.
Is that going to make them more warmly receptive to the Korean boy that's making the soccer ball? It doesn't sound like it might.
No, your points. I want to get back to your first point, but let me speak first to the second one. I wasn't citing that as an example of what would change people's hearts. I was citing that as an example of we must endeavor to create, on a collective level, policy change and institutional change, not just lifestyle change, is what I was trying to say. And I was merely giving that as a little example. There are myriad examples. What if mega corporations over a certain size had to pay for the environmental destruction that they do? That would be another little example.
Sounds fair. it just seems to me that if I have a house and I'm going to try to sell it for a high price and the government is imposing a heavy tax on me, that's likely to build resentment and probably lessen the possibility that I'm going to be part of an effort to help the vast majority of the population that's needy.
Okay, and I don't want to get sidetracked into an argument about that, but it's a very important and good argument, and we could do it afterwards. The point simply is that collective political action is part of the whole scene. That was really the point. But your first point that you made, I thank you for, because it's terribly important. I had the same critique. When I read Luther saying, the thing that I had read here, the thing that you were responding to, the Christian should be guided in all his works by this thought and this thing alone, that he may serve and benefit others, considering nothing except the advantage of the other, caring only for the other. As a feminist theologian, I was angered by this, because that notion that we ought serve the other and not ourselves has wreaked havoc on the lives of women for centuries and centuries. So I thought, this I cannot buy. But reading deeper in Luther, because Luther was so biblical, and because that notion is not biblical, loving others but not self is not a biblical notion at all. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself is the great command. I think reading Luther, I realized that self-love, caring for self, is implicit in his writings. It's implicit in his economic ethics. It's not, you'll read many things, for instance, one is responsible first to care for the needs of self and family and servants. And this is a man, because in his day it was the man that was economically responsible. Cares for the needs of family and servants, and then doesn't accumulate economic extra, but serves the needs of the other. So it's very implicit, but very, very present, that the needs of self are served. And in other of his writings, you see many admonitions to go out and take care of yourself. In his table talks, when you're depressed, you're supposed to, I don't know, go out and eat, drink, and various things. I mean, he talks about ways of being kind of good to yourself throughout. So, but your point is very good, and it needs to accompany the statement that I read of his. Yeah. Michael, and then the gentleman in the black shirt.
Follow up. I mean, I think part of that, and that's why it takes time to develop it, is that Luther is always working paradoxically on that. If you think about his little treatise on the freedom of a Christian, and he has the two statements that first of all, a Christian is Lord of all and servant to none, and then he switches that around and says is servant to all and Lord of none. And so now you always have that dialectic, that paradox working back and forth. And same here with the notion of love. There's other places that part of it is his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, where he would go through and start talking about things that really, until you love your neighbor, you don't really love yourself. And then switch that around the other way. Unless you love yourself, you don't really love your neighbor. And those two are always going back and forth. And if you do just one side or just the other, it's imbalanced and leads to some kind of abuse or perversity or whatever you want to call it in terms of ethical action.
That's very good. And a specific example of that is in his, I think it's the body and blood, the holy and true body and blood of Christ. And he's talking about the communion of love that is formed. And look at the language. As love and support are given you, you in turn render love and support to others. So here's this dialectic that Michael was mentioning. And he really says first, as love and support are given you, then you return. It's kind of like Dietrich Bonhoeffer's notion that we can't be for others until we're with others. And being with others is a mutual relationship of receiving and giving. So that paradox is present.
Read
yes.
That phrase again.
That I just read?
Yeah, you just read.
As love and support are given you.
See, I think the traditional sense is love your neighbor as yourself is that there, as you love yourself, you will love your neighbor. That's the traditional understanding. But to me, it's how do I use the basis of loving myself as the way I love my neighbor? That to me is not the basis on which I love my neighbor. And I think that's an incomplete sentence. Love your neighbor as you yourself have been loved by God. And mm-hmm. that's what that statement mm-hmm. says. Mm-hmm. As you have been given love by God, mm-hmm. you love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. That the self isn't even part of the equation.
Well, I don't know about the self not being part of it, but what the previous things that you just said is how I read Luther. As we have been, are loved by God, as we are recipients of the love of God, we become lovers with the love of God. Progressively, over time, and he's very clear, and this is one of his other departures from medieval theology, it's never an issue of moral perfectibility. We never become perfect. We never become perfect lovers. We are always rusty tools. Let me try to read that to you. It's a lovely statement, because we're not talking about moral perfection. Shoot. Well, I don't know where I wrote that down. Anyway, we're shaped and formed by God, by Christ and Spirit within us, but never towards perfectibility in this life. But it is, as God has given the love to me, then it is loved out. You, sir, in the black coat, have been waiting to speak.
Oh, just a clarification from you. Mm-hmm. Back to where you were talking about taxing.
Yes.
As you were talking, I became confused.
Yeah.
I thought you were saying that we would be taxed if we owned a home at a certain level. Or higher level. The higher the level of the home we're in, the more taxes we would pay. Not when we sold it, but while we had it. Did I misunderstand you?
No, you are saying what I was saying. That is correct. But I also do want to say I wasn't making a formal proposition about taxation.
No.
I was making a principle, discussing a principle of public policy change as a part of our call to love. Being highly political in the best sense of the word, participating in the public decisions that shape life in our community is part of our task. It's one that we have not been formed into, most of us as human beings, but it is part of our ongoing task. You know, was it Plato? Was it Plato? Was it Aristotle? Who was it? I don't know which one it was. I think it was Plato that gives us the definition of an idiot. You know, an idiot, in his language, is a person who is apolitical, not political. Political meaning a public citizen, a participant in shaping the public life. And when the public life is stampeding along economic ways that are undermining the public good, then we've got to be public political people. That was really the point. Taxation is a very powerful tool, though, and we could have lots of debates about taxation up here. Other hands, Paula.
I would like to enlarge a bit on God's love through Christ for us, makes us where we are and who we are today.
Mm-hmm.
But considering that everything begins with God, the earth, everything it contains, the air, the clouds that bring us rain. I learned as a child to waste not, want not, to pay attention to my needs, not what I want. And thirdly, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, leave it just a bit better than we found it.
Well, that's we could name those as three principles of radical economic change, actually. But those are wonderful.
I'm a dreamer.
No, thank you.
People used to think that, and I think a lot of people still do. But it just seems like there's just, you get stampeded with so many other people who are just focused on making millions, you know, and they don't care what gets in their way. You know, they just kind of like this, well, big companies like this soccer kid, you know, soccer balls. I mean, I never knew about that. And how do you find out about what these big, the really ones that are causing all the trouble, huge profit makers?
Well, in response to that, that again, the questions that have been asked her are so good throughout this week. That's a very important question. How do you find out? How do you even know? A parenthesis I'd like to put before responding that is that it's very easy for us, people in critical positions, myself, others in this room, talking about the global economy, to use terminology that's very unnuanced. It's easy to say companies or business. And that's a terribly falsifying generalization. I'm not saying you did that. I'm saying in my response.
Sure.
Companies and business range from a mom-and-pop grocery store to global corporations, 51 of which are amongst the 100 largest economies on Earth. Did you follow that? 51 of the 100 largest economies on Earth are corporations. So company and business has a vast range. So it's a falsification. And if I talk about business or companies as causing this, I'm really talking about the power of enormous global corporations and finance, Wall Street kinds of institutions. So, and then in response to what you're saying, how do we find out about the negative impact in many ways of mega corporations? How do we know that mining companies, global mining companies right now in the Philippines, are gutting mountains, destroying the terrain so much that tribal peoples can no longer exist? How do we find out that 90 Amazonian cultures have disappeared in the last 5 to 10 years? Disappeared because of economic activity in the Amazon. There are a lot of ways to find out. I think it's beginning with plugging into information lines. Co-op America is a very now well-known organization. You could look it up on the internet, that publishes a quarterly journal that gives this kind of information and suggestions on socially responsible investing, buying and selling. So we could talk more about specific information lines, but it's all out there. All the information is there. Ralph Nader's group, Public Citizen, has a little unit called Trade Watch, and there is tremendous information compiled there. There's a little booklet called Consuming for a Better World, and it really gives guidelines on products to buy that have made companies that have made commitments to. How can you decide to buy your apples from an apple grower that treats his or her workers well, not from an apple grower who doesn't? How do you decide to buy soybeans from, you know, the South Dakota farmers are being wiped out by Monsanto and Cargill because they're buying soybeans at low prices. I had a South Dakota pastor in one of my sessions that I was teaching, not here, and I was talking about the silent deaths by hunger every year in other countries, and he waved his hand and he said, "I'm a pastor in South Dakota, and the family farms in my parish are being destroyed because the big companies are consolidating. There used to be many of them, now there are 4 in the world. They can price grain prices way low. The farmers can't sell their grain at a decent price, and these family farms disappear." And I said to him, what was his name? What was his name, Ron? I wish I could remember. He was an older man.
Leroy Eisinger.
Who was it?
Leroy Eisinger.
Yes. I said to him, "Leroy, what happens to a family farm when the grain company can force it out of business like that?" And again, this is a global corporate grain company, not a... He stood up at my chart up here where I had written silent deaths, and he just went like this. He underlined silent death. And so back to your question, the answer is, how do we plug into that kind of information? And then what do we do with it? And I would say, and my mind isn't going to spew out journals or organizations for you right now, but Co-op America is a lovely beginning. They can plug you into other ones. There's a film video company, and I'll get to you right there, that we were seeing all of the films this week, a film fest, and the video company was Bullfrog Videos. and they had some great environmental videos that give information in a very memorable way. And I think the phone number was 1-800-543-FROG. And that would be a way to start doing a environmental film fest in your church about the impact of, say, various mega corporate activities. Sir?
I think you were hinting earlier about publication by a Council on Economic Priorities.
Right.
It's a very small little book.
Yes.
And I happen to be in the middle of it now. It's just called Shopping for a Better World.
Yes.
And what I appreciated about it is that they pull from so many different perspectives. They're talking about the environment. They're talking about working conditions, you know, a number of different aspects. And they're saying, if you put all of that together and look at corporations, what do you get? And they rank them. They put them by, for example, they have the beverage companies of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the world. And then they just rank them. And they do that with a lot of the major corporations. It's really enlightening.
Thank you. That's exactly the book I meant. And it reminds me that there are many businesses seeking to be socially and environmentally just and sustainable. They stand to not make the same kind of money, I mean the same amounts, therefore to be less desirable to investors who are not being socially responsible investors. And so it bears moral weight to seek out those companies and do business with them, which might mean paying a little bit more for our food or our tennis shoes, but that's a way that we can live into a different kind of economic reality. A book called The Ecology of Commerce is written by a very successful businessman, Paul Hawken, talking about principles for business and for consumers to look for in business. Ron.
I mean, you mentioned socially responsible investing. I mean, that is a way where we can have a direct impact also, not only through what we purchase, but also how we invest our money, whether it be a pension plan, whatever. I know when I bring that up amongst my colleagues in the church, now that the ELCA offers a socially responsible category, it's like, well, but I still don't make as much as if I invested in the original fund. And I hear from parishioners as well. You know, I can make more money this way, and therefore I can give it away. Well, I've never said this, but it's certainly gone to my mind. Well, then, if you make that much more by not investing in a socially responsible manner, why don't you give it all that differential all away, if that's your rationale for investing in something not socially responsible. Otherwise, invest socially responsibly.
Good point. Yes. Yes.
The problem to me seems more like the destructive, obsessive behaviors that we have. And, you know, how do you change behavior? You can look at it, it's like the alcoholic. You can try to help and do things, but you aren't going to change them until they start changing their behavior. And, you know, all the things that you do has some impact, but it doesn't have what you desire. So how do you get the church to address your behavior, not so much about, you know, how I do it, but why I do it.
Why I do it. So some deeper inner driving forces that move us to continue in ways of economic injustice.
But isn't that what the gospel constantly does? To speak to us where we are about God's presence and love and grace and a calling to do the same. You know, that's the behavior. To me, the how is where we don't quite get. When I read the various screens for the ELCA Social Purpose Fund, tremendous number of screens, and I was very impressed by that. talking about discrimination, talking about women, workplace, salary levels, you know, all kinds of things, economically, environmentally, tuned in, you know, that's good. But I think it has to be some way to find out how to do that, how to make some difference.
You mean practically how?
Yeah.
Well, there are multiple ways. I could challenge everyone in this room in the next 4 months to, in community, with a group of other people, be it parishioners or not, to find 5 sources of information to show y'all ways that radical changes could be made in your lives. Not only our life, let me say our, because I'm not doing anything more than anyone else in this room. So let me make that the first person plural, our, not your. Sources of information and ways to shift. One of my good friends says that their family does 1 change a month, solidifies that change, and then adds on another change. Solidifies that, adds on another. And I caution us all against depending too highly on individual change, that we also need the social structures of which we're a part are also what we need to be a part of collectively influencing. But that question and that response are a beautiful segue to just one more little bit that I'd like to share, and we won't go all the way into it. We can't. We don't have time. I asked Luther, I mean, I have found Luther fascinating on this. I said to Luther, if God lives in us, and if that God living in us is so vehemently convicted and able to serve the well-being of the other, love the other, and you should read his economic norms. They're just astounding. They're so radical. If that is true, then why are we so morally passive in the face of economic injustice? What's the story? Jesus Christ lives in me, and I go on this way. And what I got from Luther was this. I'm not talking about mystical messages. I'm just talking about digging through his writings. When I asked that question, I got an answer. And the answer was that the indwelling Christ, Christ coming to live in us, is pure gift. And we realize that gift. We come to know it, embody it, live it, you know, embody it through particular practices. And he named 6 throughout his writings that I discern, and there may be many more. One of them is hearing the preached word. One of them is prayer. It's interesting what he says. Note how Paul devotes himself to the welfare of the community. But we do not rightly heed his example. We do not avail ourselves to the gospel's power in the struggles of life. Unquestionably, the trouble is we do not earnestly pray. Now that says something. The 2 practices that I found most fascinating, and our time is up, so I'm not even going to name all 6 of them. I'll name those. But the 2 that were so fascinating to me, one was being with and be on behalf of the poor. It is really in serving the poor, and I don't want to use the poor, I don't use it anymore, in serving people who are in need, people who are impoverished, people who are suffering in one way or another. This is one of the practices that actually enables us to embody the living Christ. The other practice that is utterly fascinating is communion. It's the Eucharist. His most profound economic writings are in his Some of his profound economic writings are in his treatises on the body and blood of Christ. So I'll read you one quote and then we'll stop. And we choose just one. By means of this sacrament, all self-seeking love is rooted out and gives place to that which seeks the common good of all. When you partake of this sacrament, therefore, or desire to partake of it, you must in turn share the misfortunes of the fellowship. As love and support are given you, you in turn must render love and support to Christ in his needy ones. See, as you uphold all of them, they all in turn uphold you. Christ has given his body for this. Well, I won't read more. But there are statements like this that the sacrament is intimately connected with serving the needs that are present. And if those needs aren't being served, the sacrament isn't being celebrated. I challenge you to read a couple of his documents on the sacrament. Let me just name two. And with that, we close. One is the Blessed Sacrament of the Holy and True Body and Blood of Christ and the Brotherhoods. I'll write them down on the board when we're done. The other is the Sacrament of the Body and Blood of Christ against the fanatics. Read them and hold in light of reading them the Global Economy. And my point is to say that the power to realize God's love power in us comes from certain practices, the ability to embody that. And one of those is the way we practice the sacrament, and one is our solidarity with people who are in need. With that, we'll close. Thank you all for your good questions and comments.